It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and today we're getting medieval. Game of Thrones is beginning a new season. Fans have been waiting a long time to get back to this Dark Ages fantasy. Buff guys with big swords, gorgeous women in and out of amazing dresses, and the killing. There's something so strangely satisfying about watching a bunch of actors in medieval costumes get hacked, gutted, and beheaded. But is any of this actually true to life? To find out, Steve Paulson called Kelly DeVries, a medieval military historian who consults on scenes just like this.
Kelly, I guess I should actually ask, are you a fan of Game of Thrones?
Oh, yes, I'm a fan. I watch all the medieval stuff. I've watched some really bad medieval. This is a lot better, thank heavens.
How realistic are the weapons?
Oh, the weapons are wonderful. And sometimes I have real questions because I do a lot of work with the Royal Armouries in England, and arms and armor historians can be very particular. There are some really bad suits of armor in medieval movies and in TV shows over the time. This one has set out to make things real or plausible at least. Let's put it this way. If I got hit by a sword in Game of Thrones, it would hurt. And if I got hit with a sword in the Middle Ages, it would hurt. And it probably would hurt the same.
Did armor really protect people? I mean, would it protect someone from getting sliced by a sword?
Yes, absolutely. Sometimes some of my colleagues will say, no, on mail, which is chain mail for everybody else. There's this mythology about hitting the armor and the rings will just burst. They didn't. I've seen experiments, and then I've had TV shows that I've been consulting actually take the biggest guy they could, put a mail coat on a mannequin that moved, and just take a whack at it with whatever weapon you've got. They never can break through that armor. I mean, there's no doubt if you got hit with a big sword, you would feel it for days afterwards, but you wouldn't be cut.
Have you ever tried this? I mean, putting on a suit of armor and having someone whack you?
I have, and let me tell you, it takes a little bit of guts. At that moment where the swing is in progress, suddenly your beliefs go right out the window and you say, okay, have I been completely wrong on this? And then when it bounces off, you feel very, very justified and also kind of thankful that you were right. One of the things I did was wear a suit of armor that was based on Henry VIII's suit, which is kind of insulting because it was the only one I could fit into. But when it came down to it, I was absolutely impressed by the way that armor moved. In many ways, you know, having played football as a kid, it was far better than football uniforms.
Isn't armor really heavy, too? I mean, isn't it like weigh lots of pounds?
When they get to plate armor, you're looking 60 pounds. And it can go up. I mean, tournament armor, which was the most protective armor, is obviously the knights there were less worried about movement and much more worried about protection when you're charging at somebody else with a horse and a lance. That armor can go well up to 80, 100 pounds. It takes two people to arm anyone. You cannot put armor on yourself.
Yeah. Now, when we watch Game of Thrones, I mean, obviously there's nonstop action. People are dying constantly. Battles are on every front. Is that what actually happened back in the Middle Ages?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there was war constantly. The difference is that not many people did die. And not many people did die because the armor was so protective. And also battles were extremely short, 2 hours maximum usually. There's one or two battles that I calculate to be about 20 minutes total.
Why were they so short?
Well, because the object is not to kill the other side. The object is to get them to run away. If you're a single man in a line of other townspeople and somebody says, oh, you're fighting for that guy over there who's extremely rich and he's got a nice banner and he's very colorful and everything else, that tie to that man is going to dissolve as soon as you start seeing bloodshed and the trauma of battle and so forth.
Now, the other thing about Game of Thrones, I mean, speaking of the violence is, I mean, there's just a lot of brutality in this show.
Yes.
I mean, this is probably the signature feature of Game of Thrones. I mean, people get their heads chopped off, other mm-hmm. body parts too. There's torture fairly routinely. Mm-hmm. Did this kind of thing happen?
Not often. Even at the Battle of Hattin, for example, in between the Second and Third Crusade, the one that Saladin wins, most of the Crusaders live. And because of Saladin's piety as a Muslim, he's not going to kill individuals who might actually convert to Islam. There was a real value of human life in Christianity for Europe and in Islam for the Middle East.
So all those TV scenes of people getting beheaded or having their hands chopped off, that really didn't happen.
It's funny. One time there was a TV show asked me, what about a beheading? We'd like to see a beheading. And I said, well, if you think about it, I mean, you're looking at a man who's wearing a helmet, which descends onto his neck. Then he's wearing mail coif underneath that, which will cover the neck. Then he's probably got armor that's coming off the torso that's covering his neck. So you have to get through those three layers of armor. Then whatever he's wearing underneath, leather or padded felt. Then the skin, the muscle, the bone, and back out the exact same way. The likelihood of that, of a beheading, is very, very slim. So they said, well, why? How would someone kill a person on a battlefield? And I said, well, you disable him. You knock him silly with your sword or with your mace or whatever. And then everybody had a dagger. And at that point, you went up and you lifted up the armor that was covering the neck and you went in there. Or you lifted up the armor that was covering the armpit, went into the heart. Or you lifted up the armor that was covering the groin and you went into the femoral artery. And the TV show says, well, we can't show that. So they could show a beheading, but an actual death when somebody is, you know, the fact of the matter is there was no reason to kill anybody on a battlefield. In fact, if you were a lower class citizen, a poor individual, you actually wanted to capture that guy because it was an ability to get his ransom. And he was much more wealthy than you were. I call it the yuppie program in the Middle Ages. It was an immediate economic boost. So when you do find that people are killing prisoners on the battlefield, such as the Ottomans at Nicopolis or Henry V at the Battle of Agincourt, everybody decries it. It's not just that they can't understand it, but economically it's just really stupid.
So one thing I'm still trying to figure out is why we keep getting all of these medieval stories that are just hugely popular in movies, in TV. I mean, you've mentioned Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings. I mean, the list goes on. Yeah. What is it about the Middle Ages that just that gets us?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. First of all, I think that it is a period where you do see honor that still can be between individuals. The notion of a man standing next to a man so that he can actually feel his breath, so you actually feel it leaving him with this death stroke, that produces a personal connection with your enemy that is gone in later periods. So I think the notion of of honor becomes extremely important to our interpretation of the Middle Ages. So I think that that's one of the reasons. But I think the second reason is we don't have any direct connection with it. We know that our ancestors must have made it through the Black Death because we're here. But we don't, you know, very few of us can trace our lineage back to that point in time. So
we can rewrite the Middle Ages to fulfill our fantasies.
Exactly. And we don't. I mean, could you set something like this in the Vietnam War? Not when people are around who actually know the Vietnam War or even World War II. People would say, no, no, you can't. It's too close to us. In the Middle Ages, that far away. So we don't have any stock in the actual accuracy of the Middle Ages except for fuddy-duddy professors like myself.
Kelly DeVries is a historian at Loyola University and at the Citadel, where he teaches medieval warfare to the military leaders of the future. Now, some people prefer their medieval adventures up close and personal. Producer Aubrey Ralph takes us inside one of those groups.
About 15 years ago, my friend Mike took me to a park near my home in Florida and brought me into a group that I would never forget, the SCA, Society for Creative Anachronism. If you've not heard of them, they're a worldwide group dedicated to recreating the arts and sciences of the Middle Ages. You could almost think of them as experimental archaeologists, with members studying everything from medieval recipes and songs to art and chemistry. But what they're really known for is the fighting, heavy armored combat. Well, it's a Wednesday night in Madison, half a lifetime later, and I'm walking up to a fighter practice. I know I'm in the right place because there are armored soldiers milling around outside. The fighters in the SCA are broken up into a few different groups. Armored combat, rapier, which is like fencing, and archery. I got to fight as a Roman legionary, armored infantry. I do mean armored, too. This is no costume stuff. All the weapons are made from inch-thick rattan, and that can pack a serious punch. Your armor has to be able to stand up to it. This is an area where the diversity and time span of the SCA really shines through.
It's 600 to 1600, so if you want to do Dark Ages Frank from right after the fall of Rome, you can do that. If you want to do a 16th century Knight of Queen Elizabeth, you can do that too.
Most people make the bulk of their armor themselves, one piece at a time. You go to an armorer's house, and they show you how to pattern and cut the metal, and then hammer it to shape and fit and form. When it's finished, your efforts are put to the test, not only at the biweekly fighter practices, but also at huge gatherings called wars, held several times a year around the country. Imagine a medieval tent city and bazaar adjoining a battlefield. There's music and games and things to buy and eat and drink, and of course the war itself. At the big fights, there can be hundreds of soldiers on each side. Units are lined up, and then the call is given. Huge formations march towards each other, slowly at first, and then nearly running. Your breath is hot and loud in your helmet, shield up and sword at the ready. All your muscles are tensed for the crash, and then it begins.
It's a pretty intense experience. There's a lot of stuff coming at you really fast. If you don't react properly, you get hit sometimes, and that's not always fun.
Fighting is hard, and you might be killed, but just for a little while. After it's over, you get back in line and do it all over again. So if your real-world life is lacking in community and thrill, and virtual worlds aren't for you either, the SCA just might be. With time and patience and hard work, you can advance through the ranks, perhaps even to royalty. A former baroness I spoke with told me the reason she first joined.
They were going to let me wear pretty dresses. That was it.
Me too. That was pretty much it.
They were going to let me wear pretty dresses whenever I wanted, and fantastic.
I think we can all raise a glass of mead to that.
Producer Aubrey Ralph drinks his mead in Madison, Wisconsin. I have to confess, I prefer my Middle Ages safely between the covers of a book. I'm a huge fan of historical fiction. And coming up, we've got a gritty crime drama set in the year 1385, Dark Times, and Nicola Griffith's immersive, visionary novel inspired by a real woman of the 7th century. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. We're getting medieval in this hour. And here's something for all you English majors.
Juan that April, with his shortest suit, the drought of March hath pierced the root, and bathed every vine and switch liqueur, of which vertu engendered is the fleur. When Zephyrus ache with his sweet breath, and spirit hath in every holt and heath, the tender croppus and the young sun hath in the ram, his half course he run.
The opening lines of The Canterbury Tales by Geoffrey Chaucer, written more than 600 years ago, and college students still have to memorize it. Medievalist Bruce Holsinger has given Geoffrey Chaucer and his friend and fellow poet John Gower some new adventures in a thriller called A Burnable Book. Bruce, when your novel opens, the year is 1385, which I know you think was an important year. Why? What was happening?
It was a really important year. It was the year a truce with France was about to expire. We're only 4 years after the Great Rising, the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. Richard II has been on the throne for a number of years, but he's still only 19 years old. So it's really an extraordinary time for city and country alike, and just a general time of crisis. The age of Richard II is called an age of crisis for a reason.
Are there any parallels you draw between the world of 1385 and our world today? I mean, in terms of, I don't know, the zeitgeist, what people were thinking or worrying about, or even political or social issues?
I would. I think there are a lot of parallels. There's a lot of parallels in terms of communication, which obviously moves a lot more slowly. But anything you write can get out of your hands immediately. Somebody has compared what happens in manuscript culture in the Middle Ages to tweets gone wild. You know, if you write something, your scribes can take it and revise it and twist it and distort it any way they'd like.
But that's fascinating because, you know, a lot of the plot of this book revolves around a single copy of a book that everybody is hunting for. And as I was reading it, I was thinking, it's so hard to imagine an age when there would be just one copy of a book. You know, we live in the age of infinite digital copies. And yet at the same time, information is still power. Think about the furor over WikiLeaks or the hunt for Edward Snowden's files.
Exactly. And in the Middle Ages, manuscripts did have a kind of erratic charge to them. You know, single manuscripts could be invested with kind of enormous sacred and political and cultural energy. So you have manuscripts like the Lindisfarne Gospels. Beowulf, for example, survives in a single manuscript. So does Sir Gawain and the Green Knight.
If a manuscript had that kind of charge, how did people think about language, writing? They must have felt even more potent to them than it does to us today.
Oh, it does. And the Middle Ages gave us some absolutely wonderful metaphors for thinking about writing. Almost all writing in the Middle Ages is done on animal skin, on parchment and vellum. And people are very self-conscious about that. Writing is an act that is done upon a physical body. The physical act of writing is in some ways an act of torture, an act of pain upon this body of skin. So those kinds of metaphors, I think the notion of writing in the Middle Ages is a very physical notion. It's a very incarnate notion, and it goes along, of course, with an incarnate religion that thinks very carefully about faith in terms of the body, the relationship between the flesh and the spirit, and so on.
Hmm. No wonder the writing was earthier in some ways.
It is earthier. It's very – although there's a lot of earthy writing today as well, of course.
I was thinking, well, no, there's 50 Shades of Grey.
50 Shades of Grey has nothing on the medieval fabliau. I mean, there have been court cases about whether it's okay for Chaucer's Miller's Tale to be taught in high school. I mean, there's enormous amounts of obscenity in medieval literature. And that's one of the things that I love about medieval literature is how – its bodiness, its earthiness, its bodiliness.
You know, it also sounds different. I mean, it's written in Middle English, a lot of it, right?
Yes, indeed.
Is there any of it you have by heart that you could recite? Because I always love hearing what the words sound like.
Absolutely. Well, my favorite passage in all of Middle English literature comes near the end of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which is a romance written at roughly the same time as the Canterbury Tales and the events that take place in a burnable book. And my favorite moment comes when Sir Gawain is walking along about to meet the Green Knight, and he knows he's maybe facing his death. He's pretty sure he's going to get his head lopped off. And he passes by a cliff, and the poet writes, "Van herde of that he hot he hill, in a hard rock beyond the brook, in a bonk, a wonder brem noise, quat! It clattered in the cliff, as it clave should, as on upon a grindlestone hath grounded a seath." And what's happening there is he's passing by a high hill, a hard rock beyond the brook in a bank, and he hears a noise. What the noise echoed in the cliff, and what was it? It was somebody sharpening a scythe upon a grindstone. And what Gawain is hearing is the sharpening of the axe that's about to cut his head off.
Oh,
and that's, I mean, that's suspense right there. That's worthy of anything in Stephen King.
So we should back up and talk a bit about the plot. Can you just sketch the plot for us a bit, would you?
Sure. Well, the way I like to describe this book is if you could imagine a season of The Wire set in Chaucer's London, you'd have something like what a burnable book feels like. The story itself is about a hunt for a dangerous manuscript. It's a book of prophecies foretelling the deaths of England's last 13 kings. And the final prophecy in the manuscript, the 13th prophecy, concerns the death of Richard II. It's a story of murder, crime, vice, urban corruption, political intrigue, and also a lot of moving parts and points of view.
God, I hope HBO is calling you.
not quite yet. We'll see.
It's such fun talking with you. I guess I just got one last question. It's sort of a large one, but I'm curious to know what it means to you to have a historical imagination, or if that phrase means anything to you.
you almost have to leave the fact behind from the beginning. And I think to have a historical imagination that allows you to write a historical novel, let alone a historical thriller like A Burnable Book, you have to value the past on its own terms while translating it into contemporary terms. You have to take this world that can seem utterly foreign in so many ways, a world of utter depredation in some ways, but make it a kind of living and breathing thing for contemporary audiences. And that's the real challenge, I think, with historical fiction. And I think it's what distinguishes great historical fiction, something like Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, that takes you into just the most intimate moments of people's lives living 500 years ago and yet makes them absolutely compelling for contemporary readers. And I think a sense of empathy is absolutely necessary for that, that notion of reaching across time and touching the past in a way and thinking about how past lives can come to new life in the present. I think that's the kind of historical imagination I think that I strive for.
Bruce Holsinger is a medieval scholar who teaches at the University of Virginia. A Burnable Book is his first novel, and he's just come out with a second in the series. It's called The Invention of Fire. We head deep into the 7th century next, where Nicola Griffith sets her award-winning novel, Hild. Griffith has legions of fans. She's won the Nebula, Tiptree, and World Fantasy Awards for previous novels. But Hild is her first piece of historical fiction. It's the story of the girl who grew up to become Saint Hilda of Whitby.
The child's world changed late one afternoon, though she didn't know it. She lay at the edge of the hazel coppice, one cheek pressed to the moss that smelt of wormcast and the last of the sun, listening to the wind in the elms rushing away from the day, to the jackdaws changing their calls from outward, outward, to home now, home, to the rustle of the last frightened shrews scuttling under the layers of leaf fall before the owls began their hunt. From far away came the indignant honking of geese as the goose girl herded them back inside the wattle fence, and the child knew, in the wordless way that three-year-olds reckon time, that soon Onan would come and find her and Cian and hurry them back. Onan, some leftwise cousin of Ceredig King, always hurried, but the child, Hild, did not. She liked the rhythm of her days. Time alone, Cian didn't count, and time by the fire listening to the murmur of British and English and even Irish. She liked time at the edges of things, the edge of the crowd, the edge of the pool, the edge of the wood, where all must pass, but none quite belonged.
Nicola, from those very first words, this world comes so incredibly vividly alive. How did you end up writing about 7th century Britain, let alone writing about it as though you'd actually lived there?
Well, I did live there, in my head, in my heart, in my mind. And it all began one day in my very early 20s. I needed to get away for a few days, so I went up the coast to a town called Whitby. And I discovered this monastery, this abbey, founded by a woman, and her name was Hild. It turned me inside out like a sock. History just fisted up through the turf and threw me, and it took the top of my head off. So I tried to find out more about Hild, and it comes down to one paragraph in a book by the Venerable Bede. She changed the world, and yet nobody knows about her. So I went off to try to find a book about Hild, and there were none. I could find nothing. So I researched for, more than 10 years, I think I researched seriously.
So you became obsessed with 7th century Britain?
I became utterly, utterly involved in 7th century Britain. The tides, I knew the phases of the moon. I researched what birds there were, because there were different birds then. I researched the trees, because there were different trees then. The weather, the flora, the fauna, the jewelry. I came across this piece of research. I found out that by certainly some estimates, women spent 65% of their time on textile production.
working on making cloth?
Yes.
No wonder women didn't make history.
they were too busy making everything else. Yeah.
One of the challenges of bringing Hild back to life is that she is a seer, a visionary. Explain what that would have meant then.
Okay. The way I have imagined the early Middle Ages, and I'm making this up, okay, as long as we're clear on that. Think of seers, think of prophets as political spinmeisters. Certainly that's how Hild regarded her job. Whenever Edwin, the king, ran into a problem where he wanted a particular outcome, it was always Hild's job to figure out what it was that he wanted and to even the things that he hadn't admitted to himself and had certainly never admitted in public that he wanted, and to feed him a prophecy that gave him permission to do what he wanted to do anyway. In Hall, Edwin King sat on his great chair with a bloody sword across his knees. The bandage on his upper arm was bulky and clumsily tied. He could barely keep still. A muscle by his eye and one at the corner of his mouth fluttered and twitched. His gaze flicked this way and that, probing the shadows. Paulinus stood at his left hand, his bony forehead like old wax and his eyes glittering. "The buckle blade was a gift from me," Hild said, "from my hand to Kian's, into his hand to protect your life."
"Indeed." Edwin rested his chin on his fist. "And how did you know he would need it?" She touched the crystal hanging at her left hip. "I am your seer." "Quitchem, you say?" He scratched his beard, thinking. "He tried to kill me, and you claim you stopped him." "Lord," he lifted his hand, "yet Paulinus here says it was the Christ's will that I be saved." She said, "Perhaps it was the Christ's will that I be born to see your path and guide others to keep you safe." Paulinus Crow stared at her. Hild stared back. "The Bishop of Christ and the Handmaid of Weird," Edwin said. "Which should I believe?"
Do you think of Hild as more historical or more fiction? That is, if we have the Game of Thrones and that kind of faux medieval world on one side, and a nonfiction scholarly history of 7th century England on the other side, where does Hild fall?
Hild, I remember being on the phone with my editor one day, and he said, "So, how accurate is Hild?" I said, "Well, you could think of Hild as an ethnology of the 7th century," and I could feel him turn pale on the other end of the phone. "Don't ever say that in public. I said, okay. Then it's Game of Thrones without dragons." He said, "That's much better." Yeah.
Well, I read something you wrote on your blog, which was really interesting, about wanting to imagine the world Hild could have lived in, a world in which she could have shaped her own life in the ways that the actual women of her time probably couldn't.
Adrienne Rich said, "We must use what we have to invent what we desire." It's our job to go back and recast the past, to make it a world that makes the present possible. Because if you look at history, is just a story. It's a story that people have told through their cultural lens based on the facts as they see them. But there are all these facts. The facts are neutral. You can go back and recast them, retell the story.
Is that why you give Hild a sword? Because there's some powerful battle scenes.
Yeah, but she never uses the sword. She does have a very large knife. It's called a sax, a slaughter sax.
A slaughter sax?
Yeah, it's a very large knife. She always had a weapon, and she practiced with that thing. She was very, very competent. Flicks and flirts of wind ran over the grassed slope. Hild lay on her belly while dew soaked slowly through her wool. She ignored it. To either side, her men inched forward. Nothing stirred.
Light began to leak into the hollow below, tinting the sleeping bandits in tones of ash and charcoal. By the fire, one of the bandits twitched, then unfolded to become a thin woman who tottered two paces before slumping into a squat with her shift around her waist. Hild looked right and left, nodded. Bowman drew, yes, it's tensed. Then she drew her hand across her throat. No mercy. Strings thrummed, spears lofted. She ran. She ran silent as a deer, muscles pumping, heels thudding on the turf, straight for the squatting woman. A spear thumped into the woman's foot, and she started to shriek and turn, but Hild was already swinging. Her stave took the woman in the throat. She felt the soft shock all the way to her shoulders. Then she was leaping over the writhing ruin, lips skinned back. Death! She howled. Death! And the dark hollow filled with men and spears and screams.
Did it change how you see her after you'd written her first kill, the first time she killed someone?
Oh, I wept for her, really, the first time she killed someone, because the first time she killed someone, it was after a battle, and there were all these enemy combatants lying around, burst open, their guts all over the field. And they were all begging for mercy, and she took it upon herself to mercy kill them. And she wept and she threw up, but she did it anyway because she had to. And once you've crossed that take a human life line, I think it becomes a little easier each time.
Do you think there's any particular reason that the Middle Ages is suddenly popping up?
I was talking about this just the other day, actually. I really think that there are many similarities between medieval times and the beginnings of feudalism. Feudalism was quite a way after this, but it was certainly apparent in, for example, Game of Thrones. Feudalism and corporate culture like Google and Microsoft, I think these charismatic leaders of these huge, world-changing entities, they're just like kings. So we got Google, for example, in Mountain View, building their own little kingdom. They're trying to get planning permission for bridges and housing developments. And in what essentially is kind of an island, almost like a peninsula, very like an island. Perhaps they won't fortify it, but they may as well have.
Then are we all the serfs?
No comment.
Okay, thank you so much for talking.
It's my pleasure.
Nicola Griffith is an award-winning fantasy novelist, and we were talking about her most recent novel, set in the 7th century, called Hild. And by the way, she's currently deep into the research for the next installment of Hild's story. So there's a question we've been asking in this hour. Why the Middle Ages now? Is there something about the medieval period that's especially appealing here in the 21st century? We began the hour with the Game of Thrones, so here's George R.R. Martin's answer.
What happened, I think, the social changes of the last 50 years has made the future something that we no longer want to go visit the way we did when I was a kid. I mean, back in the 50s and 60s, when science fiction was perhaps as popular as it had ever been, we really had a lot of belief in the future. I mean, we couldn't wait to get to the future. The future was going to be much better than anything in the present. You know, we were going to have robots and flying cars and all these labor-saving devices, and we were going to take our holidays on the moon and space stations, and we were going to go to the stars. When they took polls, everybody gave the answer, yes, yes, my kids are going to have a better life than I do, and my grandkids are going to have an even better life than they do, and we're going to go into space and we're going to go into the stars. Well, some of that came true, but also things happened to change that. I mean, people take polls now, and most people think that their children are not going to have better lives than they do. They think that their children are going to have worse lives. They're worried about things like ecological problems, global warming. I think this, people no longer believe that the future is going to be a good place. Why do I love fantasy? Let me answer that with a piece I wrote in 1996. The best fantasy is written in the language of dreams. It is alive as dreams are alive, more real than real, for a moment at least, that long magic moment before we wake. Fantasy is silver and scarlet, indigo and azure, obsidian veined with gold and lapis lazuli. Reality is plywood and plastic, done up in mud brown and olive drab. Fantasy tastes of habaneros and honey, cinnamon and cloves, rare red meat and wines as sweet as summer. Reality is beans and tofu and ashes at the end. Reality is the strip malls of Burbank, the smokestacks of Cleveland, a parking garage in Newark. Fantasy is the towers of Minas Tirith, the ancient stones of Gormenghast, the halls of Camelot. Fantasy flies on the wings of Icarus, reality on Southwest Airlines. Why do our dreams become so much smaller when they finally come true? We read fantasy to find the colors again, I think, to taste strong spices and hear the song the sirens sang. There's something old and true in fantasy that speaks to something deep within us, to the child who dreamt that one day he would hunt the forests of the night and feast beneath the hollow hills and find a love to last forever, somewhere south of Oz and north of Shangri-La. They can keep their heaven. When I die, I'd sooner go to Middle-earth.
George R. R. Martin wrote the Game of Thrones books. I don't know, do we escape the past because we're scared of the future? Or do we visit the past to enlarge and inform the present? Why do you read historical fiction? I'll post my answer on our Facebook page, and you can join the conversation there. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about something different. We're coming up on the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War, and we'll talk about one of the enduring questions from that time. Was Abe Lincoln racist? I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
Hi, this is Nick Bantock. You may know me from the Griffin and Spoon trilogies. I have a new book out called The Trickster's Hat. And the book I would like to recommend is Arturo Perez is the Fencing Master. I'd read a number of Perez's books, particularly the Spanish adventure swashbuckling type stories. And then I came across The Fencing Master. It's, for me, an extraordinary book. At its heart is this extraordinary character from 200 years ago who teaches fencing. He believes in the art of fencing as something that represents a total way of being. He is committed to his fencing in utterly dignified and honorable way at a time when his society and his culture is moving away from it. He does not want to enter into a world where any behavior is possible as long as the outcome is short-term reward. He considers commitment to his craft and his dignity the most profound of importances. And within that, there is a great story and a great fencing match. And it's a struggle between good and evil, which many of the best stories actually are. A simplification in that sense, but quite an extraordinary little book. And I think absolutely pertinent to our time. I guess I'd been looking for someone else to be talking about the way that I feel often in our day and age we can forget the quality at the base of the content because we're so carried away by the speed and the movement and the flashiness and the ultimate reward, whether it be money or stardom or whatever. because it was set in another time period and something that not many people know much about, fencing, he was able to encapsulate the essence of that struggle, I think, that's in all of us, as to make our lives dignified.
Nick Bantock is the author of the Griffin and Sabine trilogy, and his latest book is The Trickster's Hat. You can find more bookmarks and an interview with Bantock on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week marks the 150th anniversary of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. He's widely regarded as our greatest president, but one problem with icons is that sometimes they prove to have feet of clay. For instance, was Abe Lincoln really the great emancipator? Or was he possibly a closet racist who freed the slaves not because he believed in their equality, but because he needed their help to win the war?
Let the slaves and free colored people be called into the Union Army to march into the South and raise the banner of emancipation among the slaves. This wonderful proclamation of emancipation will not just free the slaves, it will free their oppressors from their sinful rule.
Mr. Lincoln, signing that Emancipation Proclamation will dishonor our founding fathers and violate the Constitution that you swore to uphold. Sir, you are taking our property, and it will destroy the country.
Mr. Lincoln, are the great principles of political freedom and natural justice embodied in the Declaration of Independence extended to us? If not, then your boasted liberty is an unholy license. Your national greatness a swelling vanity. Your shouts of liberty and equality a hollow mockery. And your prayers and hymns a mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, hypocrisy.
During Lincoln's own time, people found plenty to criticize about his stand on race. And today a lot of historians say the question they would most like to ask the man himself is, what do you really think about black people? Harvard historian John Stauffer combed through everything Lincoln ever wrote about race and slavery, and he told Steve Paulson that from today's perspective,
Lincoln was a racist, but so was just about every other white man and woman of the 1850s, which highlights the difference between that time and today. The best way to understand Lincoln is that he was a Southerner. He grew up in a sense a border state in Kentucky, Illinois, and Indiana. And so he was a Southerner, but a Southerner who evolved far beyond what most Southerners did. Most poor white Southerners were virulently racist. Think of someone like Nathan Bedford Forrest, the founder of the Ku Klux Klan. W.B. Du Bois wonderfully said that Lincoln began poor white trash, but unlike most of his peers, he rose above it.
So that's really the remarkable story about Lincoln. He came out of this background, and yet he changed his thinking dramatically, including while he was president.
Exactly. And his self-evolution, his self-making, evolved more dramatically, more radically during his years as president than ever before. When he became president, when he gave his inaugural address, his relationship with blacks was still profoundly distant. The closest Frederick Douglass ever came to losing his faith in American democracy and emigrating to Haiti is where he planned to go, was in the immediate wake of Lincoln's inaugural. Douglass ended up meeting Lincoln three times in the White House. He was the first black to meet a U.S. president in terms of near equality. Lincoln was very taken with Douglass. They became friends. But had Douglass sought a meeting with President Lincoln in 1861 or even early 1862, Lincoln wouldn't even have admitted him.
Well, to back up for a moment, before he became president, Lincoln had come from a family that had opposed slavery, but attitudes towards slavery and attitudes about race were two very different things. And
that's right.
I mean, he would often tell stories, even when he was a state representative in Illinois. Basically, I mean, he used the N-word. He would tell kind of nasty stories that, by today's standards, certainly were racist.
Correct. He would tell dirty jokes that would employ the N-word. He was very derogatory toward blacks. The number of hours that he spent with intelligent blacks was probably less than 24 in his life. And it's important to distinguish between Lincoln's or anyone's attitudes towards slavery and their attitudes towards race, as you point out. Lincoln hated slavery, and he said on numerous occasions he hated slavery as much as any abolitionist, and there's no reason to doubt that. But although he hated slavery, his vision for ending it was extremely conservative, and that reflected his attitude toward blacks. For almost his entire life, his strategy for ending slavery was threefold. One, very gradual emancipation. He said in his debates with Stephen Douglas that his vision for the ultimate extinction in terms of when that would occur would be not less than 100 years, which would have put the emancipation no earlier than 1958. He also called for compensation to masters for the loss of their so-called property, and he encouraged emigration or colonization of blacks to a different country. So, in essence, Lincoln's vision for the United States was a white one, and that was true for almost his entire life.
Let me pick up on the question of colonization, because this remains controversial to this day. I mean, even when Lincoln was president, as he was drafting the Emancipation Proclamation and freeing the slaves, he was still not at all sure that that blacks and whites could coexist in this country. He was advocating that blacks should go elsewhere, either to Africa or to South America.
And that was true of most statesmen, from Washington really through Lincoln. The most common vision for ending slavery was very gradual emancipation with colonization.
And, of course, it would infuriate someone like the ex-slave Frederick Douglass, who,
the implication
was that blacks weren't real Americans. I mean, they had to go elsewhere.
That's exactly right. In fact, Douglass called Lincoln more than once a representative American racist. And in the North as a whole, most Northerners in 1861 could not envision a world of universal emancipation, could not envision a world in which blacks had rights under the law and suffrage. By 1865, most Northerners embraced emancipation because they understood that in order to defeat this powerful enemy, the Confederacy, they needed blacks on their side. So in many respects, facing this common enemy that threatened their existence, that threatened their identity, brought blacks and whites together as never before, and Lincoln was a product of this social transformation.
Is this to say that the Emancipation Proclamation was only put forward to try to get black soldiers to fight on behalf of the Union and also to sort of take those slaves out of the South to undermine the Southern economy?
That was the chief purpose of it. Yes, that was the chief purpose. And Lincoln was very forthright in stating that. Lincoln himself believed that one could only end slaves as part of a war power measure. His generals are the ones who told him that freeing the slaves, arming black troops, was the single most powerful weapon that the Union could have on its side in ending the war. And Frederick Douglass had been saying that from the beginning of the war. He said that the slaves are the stomach of the rebellion, that slaves are feeding the Confederacy, they're building the roads for the Confederacy fortifications, and until the Union emancipate slaves, the slaves are essentially aiding and abetting the Confederacy. And Lincoln ultimately came to realize that.
Hmm. Now, to me, one of the most admirable traits about Lincoln is how he managed to change during his presidency. I mean, this is so rare. I mean, we so often hear about politicians who talk about staying the course or showing resolve and, you know, not compromising on their principles. And here Lincoln profoundly changed while he was president.
Right.
And I mean, it seems almost unprecedented that he was able to do that.
Right. It was, I think, emblematic of who he was. Abraham Lincoln, I argue, with Frederick Douglass were the two preeminent self-made men in American history. And what that meant was, as self-made meant, not someone who rose up from nothing to become rich, but someone who continually evolved and continually changed. His understanding of selfhood, of basic identity, was one in which the self was continually evolving in a state of continual flux. And that ultimately contradicts the very idea of racism, because racism depends upon a self that is permanently fixed. It depends upon one person who is white and continually or permanently superior to another person who is non-white. And to embrace, to accept this idea of a self that is in a state of continual flux ultimately contradicts it. And that's one of the reasons why the blacks who met with Lincoln in the White House, and Lincoln met with more black leaders, more intelligent blacks in the White House than every former president combined, they all said that Lincoln treated them with respect. Douglas said after his meetings with Abraham Lincoln that Lincoln was one of the few men who treated him as a man, not as a black man. And that's an extraordinary statement because Douglas interacted with a lot of abolitionists.
You have a phrase to describe Lincoln. You call him a recovering racist.
Yes. And I think that to see Lincoln that way is not to disparage him. I think too many Americans continue to mythologize Lincoln, to see him as perfect. They want to see him as though he were among us today. To see any human being as perfect is to treat him as a myth, not as a human, because to be human is to make mistakes, to be less than we would like, to commit grave mistakes, to be flawed. And so to see Lincoln as a recovering racist is to put him in his time and his place and to acknowledge who he actually was. But also, I think ultimately, it means that we have greater respect for him because we see how far he was able to come.
John Stauffer chairs the History of American Civilization at Harvard University. He's the author of Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. Steve Paulson talked with him. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. Our show is produced by Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Raymond Tungekar, and Craig Ely. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks to you for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.